Maribel is in New York at this time on one of her infrequent visits for the purpose of preparing for publication her new book, Crusaders, the life story of her parents, Marion and Arthur Le Sueur. In this book, Maribel tells,
out under the sky. Okay, this is the cherry tree carol.
The political and economic struggles in the Midwest. A few friends of Maribel's thought it would be wise and proper to arrange a get-together while she is here with us in New York City. They discussed this matter with Samuel Sillin and Milton Howard of Masses and Mainstream. They were very much encouraged, and in this way, the reception of today was crystallized. Our program is brief, but I hope interesting and important. I think there are perhaps 20 or 30 people here today who have known personally four generations of Le Sueurs. I believe that it would be symbolically proper and fitting to select as the first person to appear on this program as an expression of our faith in the youngest, or the fourth generation of Le Sueurs, our faith in the future, to present here first Maribel's granddaughter, who will read a few words that she has written entirely by herself. And I'm very happy to call before us Robin Le Sueur, and this is her mother, Deborah Le Sueur.
The great writer whose books are very lovely and good work. This work has been done with her own mind and thought. She is good to our people for making wonderful books. Maribel, the grandmother of five children, our storyteller. Maribel, who loves Indian corn and Indian things, who goes to see and talk to Indians. Maribel, who loves all children, who loves to write books for children. Maribel, who loves planting. That's my grandmother, and I love her.
Quite a few people here who would like to express their words of appreciation for the work of Maribel Le Sueur. But time being what it is, we thought it best to select one person here today who we believe could best express for all of us our attitude and feeling for Maribel Le Sueur as a writer and person. The next speaker has the deepest regard for Maribel's writing and work, and for Maribel as a human being. And I know that that feeling is reciprocated to this person by Maribel herself. The speaker, though relatively young in years, has a long record of useful service to labor and the Negro people of our country. He has been for many years an editor of Masses and Main Street. A novel of his has earned praise in national and international circles among democratic and progressive writers and thinkers. I'm very happy to present here our friend, the author of Iron City, Lloyd Brown.
After the previous speaker, there shouldn't be much for me to say. And I do want to say that, like you all, I am very happy to be here and would not have missed this gathering for anything. To speak about Meridel, I would speak not as a writer, but as a reader, as a lover of literature. Last year, Mike Gold took a trip around the country, and going through the Twin Cities, inevitably he met Meridel LeSueur, and I think that a couple of words that he wrote in his report in Masses and Mainstream very succinctly and tersely sums up what she is and what she means to us. Mike said, Meridel is an example of what a people's writer should be. She is involved in the freedom struggles of her people today. She is also the bard of their past and the herald of their future. I think that is a perfect description, because if you analyze it, you will see that in these simple words, Mike Gold has put everything together which is involved in the concept of a true people's writer. Involved in the freedom struggles of her people today, she is also the bard of their past and the herald of their future. This is a rare phenomenon, these factors, these qualities to be in one person. In my opinion, the existence of these qualities in Meridel makes her the most important, the most outstanding, the richest, the most talented of the people's writers in America. I think that one of the reasons why we love such a person is because we hate and scorn those who are the opposite. Today's New York Times book review, we have on the front page a review of another writer, another woman, Anne Morrow Lindbergh. And in this review, which is written by an authority who's qualified to write a review of a meaningless book, because she herself, Mrs. Viney, is the author of Windows for the Crown Prince, an account of her experiences as tutor of the Crown Prince of Japan. And so this qualified critic writes a review of this book, of Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who, we are told, went away to some remote beach in seclusion and sought there in a study of the seashells some meaning to life, some deeper meaning to life. It seems that in the studying of these little shells in her 2 weeks sojourn, Mrs. Lindbergh learned some deep thoughts and brought them back. Says the shells, having delivered their message, can be swept into a pocket. The author returns with her island garnered wisdom and her insights to her familiar world. The answer which she has discovered is spiritual, It has been sought and found with the same quality of perception and deep understanding that enabled Anne Lindbergh in a few brief hours in Tokyo to apprehend the inner meaning of the Japanese tea ceremony, which she described with exquisite accuracy in North to the Orient. The book, entitled Gift from the Sea, is like a shell itself in its small and perfect form, the delicate spiraling of its thought, the poetry of its color, and its rhythm from the sea, which tells of light and life and love and the security that lies at the heart of intermittency, whatever that means. The book is available with these pearls of wisdom found in the seashells. And this front page review of our leading book review section is available in 128 precious pages for $275. $2.75. And with that $2.75, you could buy, let's say, a couple of jugs of wine, invite in your neighbors, listen to them talk, and find more about the verities of life and love and everything else in one evening than you would find in a library of such meaningless and empty books written by meaningless and empty people. In fact, I could even do it cheaper. I could just open the dining room window of our apartment in Harlem and listen to the neighbors. And in a few minutes, I would learn more about life and love than you would find in this book of Anne Moore Lindbergh. At no charge at all. She couldn't do that because she doesn't have those kind of neighbors. Like her, they are of the empty, bankrupt millionaire class who care nothing about people and who think that they can find some sort of precious thoughts in seashells. Meridell, we know, finds not in such inanimate objects, skeletal remnants of departed life, sources for wisdom, but in the hearts and in the minds of people. And all of her writing and all of her work is suffused with that which the little girl said in her remarks here today. A love of people, of course, of children, of humanity. And there is more than that in Meridell's work. There is something that is extremely rare, almost extinct in our country. And that is the merging of the past with today, and of today with the future. That is one of the qualities in our country which is so rare as to be almost non-existent in our national life. And it accounts for a phenomenon which we know, that we Americans, who can do so many marvelous and wonderful things, are yet actually such a simple-minded people. We are simple-minded because yesterday is as far away as 10 years ago and 10 years ago from 100. Everything in our life operates to obliterate all meaning from human life struggle. What has gone on before and its meaning, and it all becomes as meaningless as yesterday's newspaper. Everything in our life operates in this way to obliterate the meaning of the past. In my shop 2 weeks ago, the big discussion was the atom bomb, the perils of the atom bomb, what will happen if we get into a war around Formosa and so on, but not last week. Last week, it was Jelke, Pat Ward, Vice, overshadowed, the atom bomb was gone from the previous week, and this became our principal concern. This is not accidental. And in one passage in one of Meridell LeSueur's writing, The reason for this is pointed out. A couple of lines from this book, Salute to Spring. He writes, in American life you hear things happening in a far and muffled way. One thing is said and another happens. Our merchant society has been built upon a huge hypocrisy, a cutthroat competition which sets one man against another, and at the same time, an ideology mouthing such words as humanity, truth, and the golden rule, and such. This huge hypocrisy has grown in the 20 years since Meridell wrote those lines, and today we see how the whole process has speeded up. So that in a day, with a gesture, in terms, let's say, of the Malta agreements, the whole meaning of the war against Hitlerism is for the American people thrown out. All of history, Roosevelt is now the villain, and the whole point is to prove that somebody gave away China to the Russians. For the smallest, for the most trivial advantage, everything in our that is good and worthy in our heritage is discarded. As against this, we find in the work of Meridell a fierce and a fiercely beautiful striving not to lose the meaning of the past, not to lose the meaning of the lives and the struggles of everybody who went before us, and even of our own lives 10 years ago, 20 years ago. This seems to be a theme, a thread, which runs through Meridell's work and gives it a certain vibrant vitality which makes her work sensuous, alive, anything but trivial, anything but flat. Another brief passage will illustrate this point, a typical one, and it is taken from one of the most beautiful works by any American writer that I know of, a little piece called Annunciation from Salute to the Spring. A piece which, in my mind, to me, evokes the feelings of admiration and wonder that I get, let's say, in reading a work like Walt Whitman's Lilacs at Last in the Dooryard Bloom. Writing about the mother expecting a child, she writes, far below lies the yard, lying flat and black beneath the body of the upshooting tree. For the pear tree from above looks as if it had been shot instantaneously from the ground, shot upward like a rocket to break in showers of leaves and fruits twirling and falling. Its movement looks quick, sudden, and rocketing. My child, when grown, can be looked at in this way, as if it suddenly existed. But I know the slow time of making. The pear tree knows. In our country now, as things are presented to us, everything is given from that, with the past cut off, with the roots cut off, as if what we have now was, as the pear tree, full-blown, here it is, this is what we've got. And in Meridell's work, which is beautiful, which is lyrical, it also has, for me, this all-important meaning, the meaning which is the only possible salvation for we Americans as a nation and for our culture, is to preserve, to extend that heritage, to treasure that heritage, to learn something about it, not as something in the past or something in a museum, but of that which lies submerged and deep to be sought for and to be found in the American people. We know that though they can throw out, let's say, the Roosevelt era and reduce it to a cheap political bit of maneuvering and trickery and to try to reduce the whole meaning of the war to for a small political advantage. But we know that among the people, with all the confusions, there does lie this submerged soul spirit, which Meridel in her work constantly seeks for and shows us this underground current running through. For this deep meaning, the depth of her work, as well as its beauty, it is for these reasons that I think that in our country and among all of those who strive in this field, Meridel is foremost and is the example for all.
It is very difficult for one who has known Meridel for 20 years to make a brief introduction, because as a matter of plain fact, Meridel herself is a source for inexhaustible understanding, study, and appreciation. I shall try, in the few moments at my disposal, to express in some measure, I hope, the feeling of many of us who have known Meridel very long and very intimately. Meridel is not only a popular and beloved personality in left and progressive circles in Minnesota and the Dakotas, in particular, as elsewhere, but one who first meets her and learns about her is surprised and somewhat amazed at the widespread prestige and the reputation that Meridel has in many walks of life. Less than a score years ago, when Meridel was a member of the National Committee of the Communist Party, and at the same time, the chairman of that organization in Minnesota and the Dakotas, she was simultaneously participating in a series of broadcasts on a major Twin Cities network on a women's morning program. At the very same time, while her Marxist philosophy and thinking was broadly known, she was the recipient of a major fellowship from the Minnesota Historical Society. I, for one, know no other person in the Midwest who has dug so deeply and so fruitfully in the gold mine of the people's heritage. No one has brought forth as vividly and clearly what the early German and Scandinavian immigrants who came with their Marxist beliefs from the old countries, who came into the wilderness and prairie Midwest and participated and led in the work of the Underground Railroad, in the abolitionist movement, in support to Lincoln and to pressure on Lincoln from the left when he became president. No person, at least to my knowledge, is as familiar with the life and the trials and tribulations of the Indians of that area, of northern Minnesota and of the Dakotas, and who has written so
deeply and touchingly about them. Meridel is well versed in the people's movements of that grassroots of America. The populist movement, the nonpartisan league, the Farmer Labor Party, the Wobblies, and the later Marxist-led movements. I think in order to understand Meridel Assur, the writer, as Lloyd Brown has pointed out, one must understand her as the person, as the human being. And to understand the intimate unity, the fusion of her thinking and writing with her very being and her very life. I think perhaps what to me is the most striking characteristic of this wonderful personality is that boundless and limitless understanding and sympathy and love for the people, for the oppressed people, for those who are ostracized, for those who are made victims and twisted by a cruel and vile social system. I must say that in the first few years that I knew Meridel, I didn't fully understand this characteristic of our friend. A few years later, I had the pleasure of witnessing a masterful performance of Gorky's play, The Lower Depths. This is a play, as many of you may know, which expresses Gorky's deep love and compassion for these so-called outcasts of the then czarist society living in the cellars of the Russian cities. And I recall when I saw Meridel again a few years later, I told her what a profound effect this play had had on me and how it reminded me of that striking and essential quality of Meridel's personality and character. And I thought then, as I think now, that perhaps the one adjective, Gorky-esque, could well describe an essential aspect of Meridel's approach to life, to people, to women, to children. It is a real pleasure and honor to introduce here today the indefatigable and invincible Meridel Assur, the ever youthful and always inspiring, our own beloved Meridel.
Join together in giving you this gift, who appreciate and love you and realize the wonderful work you do, we thought this tape recorder might help you.
I have to thank you in the name of 100 farmers who want to record their stories. And we've been hunting and longing for a tape recorder. because we could record all the struggles of the Middle West if we only had a tape recorder, which we haven't had. So this is a wonderful, marvelous surprise. I think my main feeling here tonight of coming to New York and meeting many old friends and many New York friends that I've met in various junkets to New York, I have such a deep feeling of a deep weave of life between us all that sometimes our country is so large and we don't meet each other, and sometimes you have a feeling of truncation and breaking off and not knowing each other. But I feel, with Robin speaking here, time has a very deep weave of growth in it. And when Nat speaks about the life that we knew in the 30s in Minnesota, and Lem Harris and many others, some who are here and some who are not here, you feel how much they made you grow and made you live and saved you from the abyss and the destruction and the decay of life. I feel very deeply the great surge and vitality of our people who have kept this close weave through this last 5 years of attack and destruction. Sometimes you have not known us in the Middle West and we have not known you here, but all this time we have been closely interwoven and closely holding a line of a human line that has not broken but has strengthened. And now I think in this day and in this time, we see the American people turning towards those who have held this line. And it's a great and beautiful thing to see that now the American people are coming out of this root, of this underground silence. And as they come out, they recognize the speakers and the writers and the artists who during this period have spoken for them and who have held this line of human worth and growth and fertility and life. Our country is a great and beautiful country, and our people are a great people. And we must never forget this or think that they are merely pawns of capitalism or our culture. Because you can't always estimate our people, you know, just by a Geiger counter or by some measurement. They have many, many ruses and many, many techniques, like the Negro people. I think that for many, many years, they have known how to speak in an underground language and how to live for a number of years, like a wheat a germ or kernel can live for a number of years, you know, and sprout in a good season. They can become very silent and they become very invisible. But it's an amazing thing that they are always there in the furrow. A good spring day comes up, a political spring, and it's amazing what green poppings go on. We have seen this in all of our history, in all of our times we have seen this. And it is even more potent and more real today. And we must never belittle or think that the American people are silent or that they are sold out or that they are giving in to fascism or to reaction, because it's they are not. I was up in the northern part of Minnesota a couple of weeks before I came here, and I was trying to sell some books there, and I found that the people were very well informed. And I asked them, how do you learn so much? How do you know so much? Well, if there were three people gathered together, they wouldn't tell you. But if there were two, they would say that they listened to the Canadian broadcast. And I said, well, why it's so secret? We're in a free country. Why don't you, can't you listen to the Canadian broadcast? The first thing the FBI asked us, they said, is, do you listen to the Canadian broadcast? So if two people are talking, they talk together. The third one comes up, they don't listen to the Canadian broadcast. So here was a whole community with a great understanding of American imperialism and so on, but would not say that they listened to the Canadian broadcast. And there are many, many instances I could repeat here of this kind of amazing, miraculous, you might say, understanding the American people who have no access to newspapers or to information. The information has been shut down now, but who from their life and from what happens have always kept in touch. I talked to an Indian woman, for example, in South Dakota, who had certainly never read a newspaper. And she said, we are going to take back our lands, she said. My hair stood up. I said, how do you take back your land? She said, well, we have many allies now. We have Asia, and we have India and China. They're taking back their lands. So we are. Well, I'm sure Sikorsky doesn't interview these people. I'll know them. This you find all over America if you go there, and I think that we should have more relationship and more identity together and know each other the better. This is the anniversary of Whitman, and I'd like to read Whitman's feeling about the city, which is what I feel about your city. At first I'm overcome by it, and then this is what I feel, which is what you all feel and see. The great city in this day is not the costliest building, nor the place where money is plenteous, where the city stands with the brawniest breed of patriots and fighters and orators. The city is beloved by those who fight the kings of power and the comrades of love, where the slave ceases and the master of the slave ceases, where the populace rise at once against the audacity of elected persons, where fierce men and women pour forth, where the citizen is the head and the ideal, where the city of the faithfulest friend stands, where the city of the healthiest father stands, where the city of the best-bodied mother stands, there the great city stands and endures. And that's the way that I see this city. Also, I think that everything that I am comes from the struggle of women and the struggle of my people in the Middle West. But I mention women because I have been a woman for 55 years and know something about it. And in New York, I have learned something further about it, also about men. I think that the great contribution of women that I see here is something that is connected with the book that I have just written about my mother and my family. It's a kind of a thing that in the Middle West that we are a kind of a matriarchy, so the sort of matriarchy. You've seen here the oldest and the youngest of that matriarchy. This is said as a kind of a snide remark, I might say, in New York at least, that a matriarchy is a, well, something very, very bad. Well, if I was a man, I would think so too, that it was a bad thing. My mother, whom I've written this book, was a woman who struggled for many years, all of her life, in fact. And I was just saying here to some people that in 1912, it seems incredible, my mother had to kidnap her children out of Texas into Oklahoma, because in Texas in 1912, a woman had no more legal authority than a man's cow or his jackass. In fact, probably less, because you could get some, you could sell your cow or your jackass. A woman was not worth much on the open market. And this was in 1912. She had to kidnap her children out of Texas and try to make a life of her own with her children. She was a socialist. And she was in the third party movements, the Farmer Labor Party, the Nonpartisan League. And she struggled all of her life in the political field and in the struggle of the people of the Middle West. In her death, she had a vision of the Middle West and of all the peoples of the world, which is very like the vision of this Indian woman whom I spoke. She thought that she was at a great conclave held in the prairies, in the plains, rising in the Rockies, and were covered with singers of every nationality. As the Indians used to always dream, from the roads leading from north, east, south, and west came the red, white, black and yellow peoples all meeting under the great sky of the plains. At this meeting, under the canopy of the sky, the leader stood. The speaker was Mao Zedong, and he was calling out the names of the people's leaders, and they rose and came forward in a great light from every country in the world. And as they came forward, great singing was heard. And then he called out America, and the very hills sang and resounded, and among those called, of a great number, Mao called the names of Marion and Arthur Lesueur, buried in the cornerstone of the future, the seed of our mighty land. This was her dream, and she hated very much America because she felt that there was great things going to be here. And she hated to leave her children and her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren, because she had what the new critics, Malcolm Cowley, calls, she did not have what they call the obscene hope of the future, the obscene faith in man. She had this faith, really, and devoted her whole life to it, and never lost faith in it, or never became a cynic, or never became a, well, it didn't matter, or never had this obscene disbelief. She was also a woman of whom Irene Paul wrote this poem, which I would like to dedicate to all the women of our struggles. Lay a flower upon her sleeping hair, my daughter, for you have thanks to give her before you say farewell. Do you walk with an air of easy freedom? Then give her thanks, for it is she who hacked your freedom out of rock. Do you walk as an equal at your husband's side? Then remember her well, who hurled defiance at her husband's scorn, and with her little children in her arms, slashed new paths for you to travel. derision beating like hail upon her face. And you, my son, give thanks that you shall know because of her a comradeship our fathers never knew, because no man is comrade to a slave. She was no smiling Madonna, the sweet and self-effacing portrait of a woman painted so many centuries by countless men. She was fierce as a bird is fierce that has to fly over high and lonely crags. With angry claws she tore at prejudice and scorn, and swooped like a hawk on all who'd rob her children of their new won height. Lay a flower upon her sleeping hair, my daughters, for all her heartache and her lonely pain, for all her sweetness hammered to pointed steel to better battle for your womanhood and mine. Lay a flower upon her sleeping hair and cherish her as you cherish the sea and mountains that climb the sky. She is our mother, mother of a new woman who will bear a different kind of man, and all will walk together through the portals of another world of which we dream, for which we struggle, in which our children will rejoice.
Thank you, Meridella, sir. I'd just like to say in a moment that there are a number of guests here. I just mentioned their names, and they'll be here a little while. Meridella will be a little here a while with us, and we can continue our lovely afternoon and evening here. There'll also be some refreshments as soon as we adjourn. I'm very happy that we have so many friends in the literary field, from the labor movement and other walks of life, including our old and dear friend, Mike Gold. I'm going to miss about 40, but I'll mention at least 10. Hugo Gellert. Art Shields. I'm going to read them faster. Bill Rubin. Barry Saber, Bill Banofsky, Aaron Morley, Roy Kopp, Dave Sanders, Edith Siegel, Labor Movement, Sylvia Hunter, Henry Toner, Vince Castillon, well-known lawyer Julie Truppen, and many, many others. And I'd like to mention collectively the friends of Meridell who met her and worked with her from Minnesota. They're here, many of them, with their families. And lastly, I'd like to express, I want to say I'm leaving out many names. I hope you'll forgive me. I just want to conclude the program. Lastly, I would like, collectively, I did have Sidney Finkelstein down, and I skipped it when I ran him off my list. Lastly, Lloyd Brown is on the program and is recorded in history already. So I'll let that Maurice Becker. The number I know should be mentioned. I'd like to say, I think, for all of us, to thank particularly Janet Ross and Ethel Hepburn, Joe Starobin and Norma Starobin, without whom this reception could not have been a success. And to thank thank Maurice Paul, Elise Hepburn, and Bobby Starobin for their help. Thank you, and now to the...
This is the cherry tree carol. Joseph was an old man was he, and he married Mary, the Queen of Galilee. And he married Mary, the Queen of Galilee. Joseph and Mary together did go, and they saw a cherry tree all red and aglow. And they saw a cherry tree all red and aglow.
Wait just a minute.
Okay, what's happened?
And all the people will be listening and wanting to know all about you, and I'm sure they've all missed you very much, so we're all looking very much forward to your interview now. Could you tell us, are you happy?
Is everybody listening?
Oh, everybody. All over the world, and especially in Minnesota. So you see, we're all so anxious.
Okay.
And we want to know, are you happy?
Everybody's listening?
Yes.
Help! That's a joke that a woman told me from Harlem. She said that Mark Antonio was having a debate, and he ended up his debate by telling this joke. And they wanted to show how happy all the Negroes were in Harlem. So they got this Negro and they gave him a speech, and they said, well, now you're going to be on the air and you're going to talk to the whole world. We want you to tell everybody how happy the Negro people are. And so he said, now you're going on the air and the whole world's going to be listening. And he says, the whole world? Everybody's listening? Help!
Well, our sympathies are with you. And now I understand that you have a child, is that right?
Yes.
How old is this child?
4 months.
4 months. And what is it, a boy or a girl?
A boy.
A boy. And what is his name?
Joseph Andre.
Oh, isn't that... Don't you think that's beautiful, ladies and gentlemen?
I'll just tell. Really have a time.
Now, would you tell us a little bit about him? Was he an easy birth? And how much did he weigh and so on? Just tell us a little bit about him.
He was 2 pounds, 12 ounces, and he was premature.
Yes.
And it wasn't easy.
I mean, help or something. And now, what does he look like? Does he look like your husband, Kai, otherwise known as Carol, alias?
I think he just looks like Joe.
Just like Joe.
Just like Joe.
And he doesn't resemble either of you, he's just himself.
He's just Joe.
Oh, well, that's nice. How about that? Well, you call him Joe.
Joe.
And what else do you call him?
Peanut.
Peanut. Oh, that's charming.
Yeah.
Now, if you would just tell us something interesting about your life and what you do and so on.
Well, I wash diapers and make formula and feed them. And that takes up pretty much time.
And what does he do now? That he's all of 4 months old.
What does he do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't sent him to work yet. He's not old enough.
Well, does he try to sit up now?
He tries to sit up, and he laughs, and he coos.
Mm-hmm. And what are your plans for the future?
Another baby.
This is the riddle song. I gave my love a cherry without a stone. I gave my love a chicken without a bone. I gave my love a ring that has no end. I gave my love a baby that that's now crying. How can there be a cherry without a stone? How can there be a chicken without a bone? How can there be a ring that has no end? How can there be a baby with no crying? A cherry, when it's blooming, it has no stone. A chicken, when it's pipping, it has no bone. A ring, when it's rolling, it has no end. A baby, when it's sleeping, is no crying.
September song. When you meet with a young man early in the spring, they court you with song and rhyme. They woo you with words and a clover ring. But if you'll examine the songs they sing, they have little to offer but the songs they sing. And a plentiful waste of time of day, a plentiful waste of time. For it's a long, long while from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September. When the autumn weather turns the leaves to flame, one hasn't got time for the waiting game. All the days dwindle down to a precious few.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.